Talking to Edmund White, A Boy's Own Story. It's published by Dutton. Edmund White, there's a feeling of depression and doom throughout your very remarkable book, and that seems to show that the term gay is really a euphemism. Don't you find that to be the case?
Well, I think now gays are considerably gayer than they were in the period when my book takes place, which is the 1950s and in the Midwest. At that time, the only conceivable model for homosexuality was either to regard it as a sin or as a sickness. My hero, who is not religious, sees it as a sickness. That is, he goes to a psychiatrist and he tries to get well. On the other hand, everything in him is opposed to the very cure that he seems to be seeking. There's a kind of wild anarchic streak in him that yearns for independence and for the expression of his own sexual nature as he feels it within him. But there are no terms at that time whereby somebody could say, yes, I'm gay and it's fine. I mean, even the word gay barely existed. I mean, one could hear it once in a while as slang. But basically, it was a medical condition. It was homosexuality, and that was a medical condition that was a disease. And I think the wonderful thing that happened with gay liberation in 1969 is that suddenly there was a different vocabulary that was given to people, and it was a political one. It was a way that gays came to see themselves as a minority group rather than as a pathology.
You say your narrator sees it as a sickness, and indeed there are episodes where he sees a psychiatrist. But was he indeed born a homosexual? Is one born a homosexual?
I wouldn't presume to answer. I don't really know the answer to that question, but I think many gay people that I've talked to, including myself, testify to the fact that at a very early point, I mean, way before puberty, one begins to feel this very strong attraction to members of the same sex, and it feels inarguable. It doesn't feel like something that can be changed through therapy, or even something that one wants to change. Of course, I mean, I think everybody, if they had complete choice, would just as soon be straight, because it's easier. You can fit into society more easily. But I think that any kind of strong passion like that, let's say somebody had a strong passion to be a musician. He might be a very reasonable sort of person who says, well, that's no way to earn a living. I wish I could be an accountant. But nevertheless, he has this passion to make music. And I think that passion is the right word here, because I think that the interesting thing is that whereas somebody like Anita Bryant, or many people who are opposed to gays, and particularly to gay teachers, have argued that, well, the problem is that there are a lot of attractive gay teachers. They come into classrooms, they form very wonderful role models for kids, and kids are misled into wanting to emulate such attractive people and to become gay. Whereas the truth is something very different, and that is that most gay people I know had terrible experiences the first few years that they were gay. As teenagers, the first few sexual encounters they had, or even social encounters they had with gays, were far from pleasant. And yet there was a strong instinct driving them on to continue with this way of life, in spite of all odds.
Are you prepared to state what sort of environmental or emotional pressures might affect a gay or a person who becomes gay?
I don't know what makes somebody gay, but once they are gay, I think that, of course, they're running very much against the grain of our society.
Homosexuality, is it really a matter of choice, or is it indeed a compulsion?
Well, what I tried to show in my book was not a theory about it, but the way it felt. I mean, I wanted to approach this thing from the inside. That is, I tried to be as true as I could to my own memories of growing up gay in the Midwest in the 1950s, and try to show how, for instance, this boy keeps saying, my boy, that is the stand-in for me, keeps saying, I wanted to have the love of men, to know the love of men, and not be homosexual. That is, he wants to avoid this terrible classification and this terrible reality of a social pariah, the homosexual. But on the other hand, he wants to be with men in something that's more than a friendly way. I mean, he wants it as kind of sexual and emotional erotic relationship. So it is like a compulsion, and I think that the history of American psychiatry, the history of American religion, is full of the stories of people who have done desperate things to themselves trying to stop being gay. I don't think it's really a choice. I think it is a compulsion.
Well, how do homosexuals see themselves? Because obviously most of America, which is straight, views homosexuality with disgust and with revulsion. How do gays see themselves?
I think it depends where they live and what age they are. I think that people who came out, that is, who recognize their homosexuality since 1969 and who live in the Northeast and particularly in large cities, have a very live-and-let-live attitude toward their own homosexuality. I mean, I'm a teacher at Columbia. Most of my students know that I'm gay. All of them know I'm gay. It's not a subject that comes up in the classroom. However, I think my frankness about it and my mentioning it when it does apply, for instance, I taught a course this fall in Proust. I was teaching the great long novel by France's homosexual writer, Marcel Proust. And so I would sometimes say, well, yes, gay life is still like that, or it's not like that. And I think that this kind of frankness that I had encouraged my own students to be frank about their own lives to me, and which was useful in, given that I was teaching creative writing. But I think many younger people have a live-and-let-live attitude. After all, many younger people, including straight younger people, are having abortions, are living in sin with members of the opposite sex, perhaps, but still in arrangements that weren't approved of by their parents. And I think a large part of America now is living an alternative lifestyle. And these people tend to accept homosexuals.
Well, of course, you live in New York City, you work in New York City, which has a huge gay population. And also New York has a traditional liberal approach toward almost everything.
But I've traveled around the country. I wrote another book called States of Desire, Travels in Gay America, in which I spent a couple of years traveling around the country visiting different communities. Now, they were all cities, because I feel that homosexuality, that gay life as a lifestyle is pretty much an urban phenomenon. It doesn't exist in small towns. I'm not saying there aren't gay people. There are a handful of gay people. And they might even have one bar in that town, but they have to be pretty careful about their lifestyle if they're going to fit into a small town community, by and large. But in the big cities, there really is a great deal. I mean, for instance, like take a place like Houston. Now, you might think that, well, here is Houston in the heart of Texas, the land of he-men, the land of oil speculators. Surely there couldn't be very many gays there. But quite the contrary, it's one of the most flourishing cities, and because Houston is not dominated the way New York is by old-line ethnic groups. That is, New York is dominated politically by the Catholic vote, the Italian vote, the Jewish vote, the Irish vote, the Polish vote, and so on. But Houston, being a brand new city full of brand new people who don't have these kinds of ethnic ties, one of the largest voting blocks in Houston are the gays. And the gays, in fact, are gaining more and more control over that town. Very similar phenomenon, of course, as to what happened in San Francisco. But this is also happening in a quieter way in places like Denver and Seattle. It's happening in a noisier and more obvious way in places like San Francisco, Los Angeles. It's happening in a very conservative, very Midwestern way in Chicago. But it's happening everywhere, even in the Old South, like Atlanta.
Well, there again, you're mentioning the large cities, big urban areas. But would you be prepared to go into, say, Alma, Illinois, or Hutchinson, Kansas, and make the same kinds of statements on the air, say, in their local radio station, the same kind of admissions that you can easily and dramatically make here without any repercussions?
I have done that, and I would do it again. I mean, I have traveled all over the country.
What has been the reaction?
By and large, I would say a kind of frightened, quiet silence. A lack of
stunned.
Repercussions. Stunned, that's the word. Stunned silence. It's interesting. I think that when someone speaks with a degree of assurance, bigots tend to step back. I don't know. I've never really... I think oftentimes one longs for a real face-to-face encounter with the enemy. Unfortunately, life doesn't present very many of those circumstances.
But not in a motorcycle bar.
No, not that.
Certainly, straight America's loathing of groups like the North American Man-Boy Love Association is understandable. But how does the gay community itself feel about such a radical organization? Does that? It would seem to me that even gays themselves would be wary of adult men who prey on younger children.
Well, your words are all loaded there. You're saying adult men preying on younger children. I think that in the defense of that organization, which I'm not sure I could entirely defend, but I would partially want to defend, I think that they themselves have tried to dissociate themselves from rapists or of any sort. And of course, most people who prey, most adults who prey on children are heterosexuals. Most adults who molest people are usually adult heterosexual men who molest little girls, oftentimes their relatives, their daughters, their stepdaughters, their nieces. I mean, this is the common American pattern. Taking into account the relative numbers of gays and straights, there still is a larger proportion of this kind of heterosexual activity than there is homosexual, and I think we should be very clear about that. It seems to be a grand old American custom to molest children. I think that what the North American Man-Boy Love Association is defending, I think prematurely, I don't think America's ready for this, but what they're trying to defend is voluntary sexual relationships between children and adults. This is, every single word in that sentence is loaded. What does it mean to say voluntary when you're talking about a child? For instance, a friend of mine called me the other day, and he's a psychologist who teaches at Harvard, and he said, I've just been asked by CBS to present a position paper for the staff on what does it mean to talk about consent. When does consent become a reasonable thing to talk about when you're talking, is it 7 years old, 8 years old, 9 years old, under what conditions, when, where, why? These are questions that he's trying to work out as a cognitive psychologist.
But doesn't the law have something to say about that? Doesn't the law establish what the age of consent is?
The law establishes that having sex with anybody under the age of 16, let's say in the state of Massachusetts, is statutory rape. So let's say a man 17 years old has sex with a girl 15 years old, he is breaking the law. He is a rapist by law. The law outlaws most homosexual acts in most states, even between consenting adults. So if we're talking about the law, I would say that most teenagers who are going out with each other and are having sex with each other and are breaking the law. Almost all homosexuals are breaking the law. Therefore, the law is way out of whack with actual behavior of actual Americans. I think
but,
it's irrelevant.
But that may be the case, but the law is set up in order to protect those who cannot normally protect themselves, and we're talking about children. We're talking about those under 16 who don't have the ability to make rational judgments all the time.
I think that the problem in this situation is that people never talk enough in the concrete. What I think that most people, I think the little movie that most people have in the back of their minds when they talk about this subject is they see a powerful, rich, unscrupulous, older man in his 40s and 50s who's covered with hair, who has big muscles, who's got a big Cadillac, and who is a monster, a villain, a Dracula, and who is preying on a poor little 7-year-old boy whom he lures with candy or whatnot into his car where he molests him. I think now try a different movie. I think that the movie more often is this, that there's a 15-year-old or 14-year-old boy who wants extra money and who is hustling, who is selling his favors to adult men. This so-called boy is 6'2", weighs 180 pounds, and the man is an older, weaker, feebler person who is thrilled to have sex with such a gorgeous specimen and is willing to trade money for this boy's favors. Now, if you disapprove of all prostitution, that's your concern. It goes on at a flourishing rate in America, and both for heterosexuals and homosexuals, it oftentimes involves rather young teenagers.
Well, let me be blunt in asking this question. Are you not supporting sexual relations between children under the age, like legal age of consent, and adults?
Well, when you ask it that way, I feel that I should consult my lawyer before I answer. I don't know what I feel about it. I find it appalling that we can't have an unloaded dialogue about this. I feel that it is probably the next great issue that faces everybody. I mean, I feel that if we'd been sitting in this very same studio 30 years ago, you could have said to me, surely, Mr. White, you don't approve of sex between blacks and whites, do you? And you could have asked it with the same kind of earnest concern that you now are asking this question. I mean, it seems to me possible that 20 or 30 years from now, people will have a very different attitude toward the sexuality of children. After all, Freud believed that children have very strong sexual urges that they long to express. There are many people who believe this. I'm not sure I know what the nature of childhood sexuality is. I'm not sure I know at this point in my life, looking back at my own childhood even, what my exact yearnings were. I would like a lot more dialogue, a lot more discussion about this. I feel that there is a way in which children are one of the most exploited groups in America, that they are very much under the control of their parents and adults in general, that they have no rights, that they have no freedom, they have no money, no choice, no say, no nothing. And I think, if anything, people 30 years from now, or 50 years from now, if all goes well, will be most appalled not by these random examples of man-boy love, but by the general conditions under which we've allowed children to live in this century and all previous ones. I think that children are maybe one of the last captive peoples. Now, look at it this way. I think that sometimes when children do have sexual relations with adults, and these are long-standing and warm relationships, that those children oftentimes have more actual power than they would have had otherwise. That is, they have actual control over their lovers. They are able to ask for things and get them in a way that no ordinary child is able to in this society. I'm just saying that I think that one of the parts, the suppressed parts of this dialogue, is a discussion about power and the lack of power of children. Children are colonized in this country by adults. And I think that one reason why man-boy love is so upsetting to people is because it suggests that maybe children might be drawn into the adult community on an equal footing, or at least a partially equal footing.
You cannot draw children into the adult world on an equal footing, because children are in the process of learning and developing, and society has mandated a role for itself to protect those who are still in that fledgling.
But I'm saying
status.
What you're calling protection is actually subjugation. And as far as what the real nature of childhood is, I think you're talking about with a great deal more confidence than you have any right to. Because the truth is, if you look at a book like Centuries of Childhood by Philippe Ariès, it describes how children have behaved in different periods of history. And for instance, in the Renaissance, it was not unusual for a child of five to know four or five languages. It was not unusual for a child of five to give sermons to large crowds of people that would last 6 and 7 hours. Children wore the same clothes that adults wore. They played they played scaled down versions of the same games. They cracked dirty jokes. They were fully participating members of adult society. What happened in the 18th century was that with the rise of the bourgeoisie, there was also the rise of family life, a highly privatized, suburban kind of family life, which in the 19th century became the cult of innocence, the cult of innocent children, and that children were these little darlings who were closer to God, who were little angels, and who were totally removed from the concerns of adult society, whether those might be competition, making money, or sexuality. It was Freud who blew the whistle on that and said, wait a minute, they're not little angels. In fact, they know a great deal of what's going on. And it was he who began to re-examine the nature of children. Now, I think that you're caught somewhere between these poles. I'm just saying that there is an that childhood is not a permanent state that has a natural parameters that must be regarded by everybody, respected by everybody, and only sex fiends think differently. I'm saying that this is a very fluid matter.
Wait a minute. It's not completely fluid in that society must establish a role, and it must make rules, whether we accept these rules, whether they have changed or evolved, whether they've gotten worse or better. This is the state that we are in. We as a people have established a role for children and have established ourselves as the protector of children. Suddenly we see the emergence of a very vocal group, which has obviously been around in a variety of personifications for years, and it seems to many people a group that is exploiting children, and society obviously reacts in such a way as to want to protect the children, because they've established this role for themselves and for the young people too. Now, I don't know if that's wrong for society to do that. You mentioned how the role of children has indeed changed over the years, and you're right. I think I've heard you talk about that before.
maybe possible. I don't know. But one of the things I think that's interesting is that the National Man-Boy Love Association, if it counts 200 members altogether, that would be an exaggeration, I think. It probably doesn't even have that many members. What is fascinating to me is that CBS, among other places, has given an enormous amount of coverage in the last few weeks to this, including the totally made-up business about maybe this boy being the picture of Eaton Paltz, but it turns out it wasn't, and that it was a little boy's picture that was taken way back when in the 60s. I mean, the whole thing has been totally invented, and I think it's totally unscrupulous.
Well, the organization itself has managed to hold numerous news conferences.
In defense of itself, after the FBI raided it. But what's fascinating to me is to look at it from a sociologist or even an anthropologist's point of view and say, why? Why is all of this focus being directed to this tiny, almost non-existent group? What does this mean? And I think what it means is that it could be that these pederasts, to call a spade, that these pederasts are stand-ins for homosexuals in general. Could it be that liberated people, such as yourself, have progressives who are heterosexual, have decided that it's no longer viable to attack homosexuals in general as a group, because that makes us sound too much like members of the New Right, or fundamentalists, or know-nothings, or fools. But we can attack this tiny, almost non-existent group, and use that as a sort of scapegoat for the homosexual community in general. Or it may have to do with larger issues about the collapse of the American family. Certainly we know that whenever society is challenged by a depression such as ours is right now, or changing mores, that usually a tiny group is selected out to be the scapegoat. I mean, that's the meaning of the word scapegoat. And it seems to me that we have a classic case of scapegoating here, that if you look at a case-by-case examination of what is being talked about in the Man-Boy Love Association investigation, usually it's a question of a boy who is fully consenting, as far as we can tell, who's in his early teens, not prepubic, who is having some sort of sustained sexual friendship with an older man. So what? But that isn't what we're being led to think. Words like minor is being cast around, boy, as though it's a 7-year-old or a 5-year-old that we're talking about, instead of a 14-year-old or a 16-year-old. Words like rape, when what they mean is statutory rape, that is legal rape, rape as it's legally defined, rather than actual rape. To me, what it finally boils down to, in terms of the actual boys that we're talking about and the actual men we're talking about, is that I'm very interested in making sure that nothing is forced on somebody. I don't believe in violence. I don't believe in violence, whether it is in the form of muggers attacking me on the subway, or violence whether it's in the form of an adult man raping a woman, or an adult man raping a boy. I mean, I don't believe in violence, and I'm very interested in trying to set up some ways in which children can be protected against violence, just as other weak people can be protected against other strong, physically strong people. But those are the real issues. Whether it's a gay, straight, man, boy, father, daughter, these seem to me secondary questions. And I do feel that there's a classic case of scapegoating going on here.
I did want to ask you a couple other questions. One, we have perennially before the New York City Council the homosexual rights bill, which is defeated every year and reintroduced and defeated and reintroduced and defeated. I would assume that you would be a supporter of that legislation.
Of course, yeah.
This bill, of course, would prevent discrimination against gays in hiring city government. But in general, why shouldn't an employer discriminate against those whose actions he feels are socially unacceptable? Did I phrase that badly?
I'm trying to think how those actions enter into the marketplace. It seems to me that, I mean, into the work situation, it seems to me that what most gays are arguing for is a right to privacy. And it seems to me it's an old and valuable and venerable American tradition to feel that what happens within the bedroom is really nobody's damn business. And I think that people who want to say that they're gay because they want to confide something major about themselves, they identify with their sexuality, just as everybody does, who want to announce they're gay, but who then leave it at that, and who conduct their private lives in private, that such people are beyond reproach, and that what, and that whether they're gay or straight really shouldn't finally be an issue. That is, I think people have a right to come out to on the job and say, I am gay, because it's, after all, you're spending a lot of your life with the people that you work with. And if you have to hide that crucial factor year after year from your colleagues, it's not a very comfortable situation. It's not
But since most America is straight, many people feel that that is not socially acceptable behavior. Thus, shouldn't people who feel that way, when they are in a position of authority, have a right to say, no, I don't want gays on the premises. I don't want to hire them. I want nothing to do with them.
Well, I mean, that's just the argument that white supremacists use against blacks. I mean, they say, I don't want blacks in my club. Thank you very much. I don't want to sit next to a black and eat. And that we have found to be wrong, immoral. I mean, it depends on whether you feel that gays are, goes back to what we first started talking about, whether you think gays are, whether it's a sickness, it's a pathology, in which case you're quite right to want to defend yourself from it. But if you recognize it as a legitimate minority group, then you should accord it the same rights that you would any other minority group. I think that's the crucial question you have to ask yourself.
A minority group, does that mean a gay people's party? Do we have a gay people's party?
In this country, we don't, though in fact gays have been an important pressure group in many cities. I mean, an important lobbying group. We have a gay lobbyist in Washington, Steve N. Dean. The American Civil Liberties Union is more and more recognizing gays as a legitimate progressive cause, and so is the Democratic Party. I mean, there are gay representatives who go to every Democratic conference now. And I think that you'll see in coming years more and more gay rights planks in the Democratic Party platform.
Well, to wrap up our conversation, I wanted to ask you a question about literature. A Boy's Own Story I enjoyed very much. It was beautifully written. There is a body of work that is done by gays, Tennessee Williams, for example, or Somerset Maugham. I don't know that in their work, as such, there was an explicit viewpoint about being gay, as there is, of course, in your book. But is there a body of literature developing around the gay community?
Sure. And, I mean, now there are quite a few gay writers who are at work. Andrew Halloran, who wrote The Dancer from the Dance, I think is a remarkable writer. There's Larry Kramer, who wrote Faggots. There are a lot of new books coming out every day, including in all different genres. I mean, they're gay mystery stories, they're gay whodunits, they're gay comic books, all kinds of high and low literature that are gay-oriented, many of them being published by St. Martin's Press, which seems to be issuing quite a few gay titles, but also by Avon Books. So I think that the gay market is certainly expanding. And there really is a gay literary movement afoot in America. In France, it's even more advanced because I think it embodies some of the greatest names of this century. I don't think we can claim anything that exalted for the United States, though there have been major writers who've been gay. But in France, there have been explicitly gay writers for a long time, including ones who won all the major prizes. This year's Prix Goncourt was won by a woman who was an out-and-out frank lesbian. Last year, the Prix Goncourt was won by Yves Navarre, who is an avowedly homosexual writer. Of course, Proust, Genet, Gide. There's a long tradition of avowedly gay writers in France who've written about homosexuality.
Dutton, of course, is a respectable publisher. We mentioned a moment ago that the possibility of some potential employers discriminating against gays. What about in publishing? Would a publisher take a manuscript such as yours and say, I'm not going to publish this, it's about gays?
Sure, sure, and that's been done a lot. I think it's only in recent years that it's not been done. I myself circulated a couple of different novels all through the 60s, and I would sometimes meet, and neither of which were ever published, and I would meet editors later who would themselves be gay. And they would say to me, well, of course I had to reject your book, because had I accepted it, somebody might have suspected I was gay. So there was a great deal of oppression of gays by gays, by frightened gays. And this is one of the unfortunate byproducts of people living in the closet. I think, again, 1969 gay liberation changed all that and continues to. There is an opening up of this closet. And I, for one, feel it's a valuable thing, because I think people should be able to be frank and open about their intimate lives.
Thank you very much for coming in, Edmund White.
Thank you, Don.
You are certainly an articulate spokesman, and you mentioned having dialogues about these issues, and I think that someone like yourself is a prime candidate for more such dialogue, and that's good. I don't think we've really touched upon gay issues on this station very much, except when the bill comes up in the city council every year, and when we have...
If you think that New York City, one out of every four adult men who live in Manhattan is gay, that's a large part of your...
Is that right?
Absolutely. That's a large part of your listenership.
Know?
Well, that's... I don't know how the pollsters figure that out, but it's not my figure. It's one I've heard again and again. So
I'd be wary about those figures. It's like people saying there are 33,000 homeless, destitute people, or 133,000, depends on who you talk to, walking the streets without shelter, and nobody knows.
But you yourself can certainly see that in areas of the city, like the West Side, Greenwich Village, Brooklyn Heights, that a large, substantial number of people are gay men. I mean, that restaurant after restaurant, bar after bar. I mean, there are so many gay businesses alone that you would say, well, they have to have somebody they're serving. And there is a gay newspaper in New York City, the New York Native, which has 100,000 subscribers. I mean, it's a large part of your listenership is gay. That's why I would suggest that you have more gay-oriented programs.
Well, I don't know about gay-oriented programs. Being a news operation, we try to cover issues. And
well, of course, gays oftentimes feel that one of their biggest problems is that they're invisible and that their news stories aren't covered. I mean, for instance, the beginning of gay liberation, which was the Stonewall Riot, which in gay history is like the Bastille Day, was not covered by the New York Times at all at the time. It wasn't news fit to print as far as the New York Times editors were concerned. The Columbia Journalism Review recently had a cover story, I don't know if you saw it, in which they were complaining about the fact that gay stories are underrepresented in the heterosexual press. The fact that we even have to use a word like heterosexual press shows you the bias.
Are you familiar with this movement by Eli Segal, Aesthetic Realism, which is, they claim that they have transformed 100 people from gay to straight. They also are upset over their lack of coverage, and they have stage vigils in front of CBS because they think they're doing something very right and very courageous. I'm not really familiar with the movement that much. But it would seem to me that they say they have changed gays to straight, but it would seem to me that a gay who wanted to be straight would be straight or would seek ways of doing it if he wanted. Or maybe he couldn't. I mean, we talked about the compulsion before. I don't know. I don't know if a philosophical movement is sufficient to change people's minds or behavior or attitudes.
Well, of course, the Catholic Church has been changing gays to neuters for centuries. That is through the priesthood. I mean, there are many, many gays and lesbians who enter the priesthood or who become nuns and then give up sex altogether. That's one solution to the problem.
I have talked to a number of clerics candidly who believe that they are... There is a great deal of sexual repression within the people who work in the Catholic Church, and it manifests itself in a variety of ways, some not very positive.
Sure.
I mean, it's a very unnatural form of life, it would seem to me.
I think so. I mean, I think celibacy is the one thing that animals don't practice. They practice every other thing, but not celibacy.
Well, we certainly talked longer than I anticipated, but
thank you.
I think we produced some good information. And
sorry, I was heated about the man. I didn't even mean to get into that man. Boy, I love stuff so much. But
I couldn't resist asking you. I had
sure. Well, it is very much in the news. I don't know. I probably said more heated things than I really believe. Except I do feel that there's a scapegoating.
I think we're going to.